Hey, welcome to Collaboracast, the official podcast of Collaborist. I am one half of your hosting team, Ben Leroy, and with me, as always, is the wonderful Jason Buchholz. Jason, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Doing all right, and I'm really excited about the reaction we got to the first episode. I appreciate everybody who listened, all the feedback we got. It was pretty cool, pretty inspiring, and I am still riding the high from it. It's great. I feel super empowered right now.
Same here. I was sent a quote from one of our listeners, a quotation. Quote is a noun. Quote is the verb. Quote's a verb. Quotation is the noun. I was sent a quotation, and it is this from Carl Jung, his Letters to Freud, Volume 2. The reason for evil in the world is that people are not able to tell their stories. I think we should hire him.
Yeah, I think we should.
I think we should get him on the team.
Figure out where he is and give him an official Collaborist sticker and badge and decoder ring. Because it sounds like the guy gets it.
I think he might. What does that mean to you? What does that tell you? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I've got a little bit of bias confirmation with that because I believe it to be true and I believe it to be very concisely articulated the mission behind what we're doing, and that so much conflict, so much tension comes from people not being able to tell their story. And it's not simply a matter of telling it. It's not simply a matter of not enough people have been handed the microphone. It's that people haven't had the time to sit with themselves and to think through what exactly their story is, and to be able to talk to others about it, and to have the space internally to figure out what your story is. And that's hard. And it's especially hard in this day and age when the public square is so full of shouting and distraction from other places. Not only do we not have the time and the space to figure ourselves out, but we are drowned out by the collective noise of others. And so, yeah, then there's conflict because people are unclear. And this would be a total personal philosophy thing. The point of human existence, as I mentioned in the last episode, to me, means to bear witness to the experience of others, their joy and their suffering, and to be able to fully recognize what it is. And I think when people are fully recognized for who they are and what they do, and they've really done the work to understand themselves, that you get away from a conflict-first mindset. You want the community. You want love. You want compassion. And you're also quick to dispense love and compassion to others. But what does the quote mean to you?
I don't think Jung would have been a big fan of the red circle notifications that fill our phones like chicken pox every day. I think he would have defined those as evil. To your comment about the public square being full of noise, I was thinking also about our same inability to articulate and to sit with ourselves long enough to even discover what it is we have to articulate. I think the word evil in that, I mean, he's taken it to the next level. When we started talking about putting this together, he's not wrong though. He's not wrong. I think that community and building community and the ability of the ability and the opportunity to tell stories and to listen to others is, I think that's sacred. I think that's what godliness is for me personally, is that togetherness. And yeah, he's talking about the reverse direction of that. So I think that he puts a sharp point on something that you and I both have been feeling and thinking about.
I know that. I was just going to say, I know that when I watch TV, if I'm watching a movie and there's the antagonist, there's the known villain, my first impulse is to dislike that person. I'll confess to my own shortcomings. My first inclination is to hate that character because they're doing the bad thing. And as soon as I get through that initial hate or anger, I then start asking myself questions like, well, what is their backstory? Why is this character the way this character is? And if I ask myself that, in the absence of an explanation from that character, it becomes easier to think that no one chose initially at birth to be the bad guy. As much as our society might try to like make hip and cool the rebel angry guy, so many of my touchstones about character development and the human condition come from professional wrestling. So I was about to use professional wrestling vernacular, but I don't know that it really fits right. Well, it fits right here. I just don't know if the audience would catch on. But I have to then ask myself, what failing on my end is it that I still am able to have such a negative visceral response if it is my stated goal, it is my intention to live in an area that when you see negative behavior, the desired response isn't to meet it with further negative behavior, but to try to understand it. This goes beyond trying to reason with it. How do you smother it with love and compassion and give it its space to feel secure and be able to work through that, knowing that people have a lot of stuff in their personal attic that is dusty and forgotten, but has had a profound effect on who a person is.
You're making
And
me think of the years that I spent in early childhood education. So, as you know, I worked at a children's center for many years, primarily with kindergartners. And so, as teachers, you get people telling on each other all the time. So, you get someone comes up and said, so and so just did such and such. And after a while, you start to learn that the first question you ask is, well, what happened right before that? And what happened right before that? And so it's you start getting at that story, and then all of a sudden, oh, it's like, well, this kid threw sand at me. Well, what happened right before that? Well, I threw sand at him. Okay, well, now we've got a whole different situation we're talking about here. And you can do that ad infinitum sometimes, but it doesn't take much to quickly develop a much more full picture of something that happened. Even these little incidents, you know, these are kids on the playground, but it's a microcosm. All these interactions, there's competition over resources, there's jealousy, there's friendships, there's love and heartbreak. It's all a microcosm of everything else that goes on in our supposedly more sophisticated adult world, which is not really any more sophisticated. It's just more expensive, and there's just a lot more stuff and higher stakes, but it's the exact same dynamics. What happened right before this for you? What turned you into somebody who is interested in storytelling?
like many people, getting into books, becoming a reader was a very magical experience for me. And I was an early reader and I was an aggressive reader. I remember often in school, like elementary school, being assigned books, and I would read that book and then I would go read three more before we talked about the first one, just because I was so enamored with story. And I would grab whatever books were available. It would be
Is it safe to assume that many of those were Hardy Boys books?
they were actually, and
Yeah.
the Hardy Boys maybe the most pivotable. I guess I'm just going to make up a word. If we're going to make up collaborative, why not make up pivotable? I found the Hardy Boys books, and my dad and I would read them together. And it was a magical experience. I can remember that I read books before the Hardy Boy books, but the first books that I remember are the Hardy Boys books. And I've gone back in later years and read them, and there's a great nostalgia that comes with them. The writing itself, I may make different artistic decisions if I was writing these books, but a small side note is that those books were credited to F.W. Dixon, I believe. F.W. Dixon was not one human being. It was basically a mill of people who were told that they could write the Hardy Boys books. So if you know that, you can kind of see some slight style characteristics depending on who was writing them.
They all knew how to lay down a cliffhanger, though.
they did. It was cool to be able to imagine yourself living that life of being important and being someone who was trying to solve other people's problems. Fascinating. That's an interesting concept. I continued to just read and read and read, and books were solace, and books were comfort, and books were educational. Books made the world available. I can remember old Time Life books about the ocean and the jungle, and just being able to read about all of these fascinating places on Earth that people today would be able to just go to YouTube or Google and see all those things. But a one glossy photo in a Time Life book in 1980 just would cement itself in the brain in a way that a lot of the more transitory media that I consume today doesn't quite hit the same way. And then sometime in the early teens, I started really wanting to write and be a writer. And I had written stories in school before that. But I mean, I really, really wanted to be a writer. So much so, here, this is the language that I would use. So much so that I wanted it to be a part of my identity. It wasn't just a matter of writing for school, but it was something I really wanted to do. And I wrote my first full novella at 17. I wrote my first full novel at 20. I've written a dozen novels that will always just kind of sit in a drawer for me. I've written a whole lot of words in my life. I've been working on the same novel right now for 9 years, almost 10 years. And to me, books and writing are a way to examine myself, examine what it means to be human, what it means to interact with people. And that's why when I was younger, I had this goal of I'm going to publish 40 novels by the time I'm dead. And now I've hit this point where I've been working on this book so long, and not at a point where I'm polishing the same book over and over because I'm afraid to let it go. You can track my spiritual, my social, my emotional development, just even within this one book over the last 10 years, just in the different drafts, because they're so radically different. I feel, do you ever read Franny and Zooey by Salinger?
Many years ago.
Okay, well, no spoilers or anything, but there's a part in there where one character is telling the other one that in the pursuit of doing art, you can't worry about the audience. You have to think about it as though when you are done with whatever the art is, in this case, it's a character who's acting. When you get done, you should think about it as though you were handing it over to God, however you want to define God, and saying, like, this is the thing that I am doing to represent the fact that I was alive. Like, this is the humanity. And like, it's not about what did the critics get it? Like, that's not it. It's like, this is the thing that internally you're saying, this is what I would give to God. And that,
I remember that passage.
Yeah, that's a really powerful thing. And it's been great. We touched on it very briefly last episode, but for those who might not know, I spent 15 years or so running two different independent publishing houses that were both of them were later purchased by a larger publishing company. The second company that I ran, Tyrus Books, was ultimately ended up being acquired by Simon & Schuster. And then that was kind of the end of me wanting to run publishing companies. But one of the most joyous things about running a publishing company is seeing people working on their art and being able to bring it to a larger audience and to get it out into the world. But that's also super emotionally draining because you have these projects that are people's life work. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that like every book written is sacred and that it's this mystical thing for everybody, for every book that they write. But there was definitely a lot of people's truest, innermost selves in their pages. And I was somebody, and, you know, this company, this conversation that we're having is testament to it. I really love seeing people express themselves. And one of the books I published was your novel, A Paper Son. It's so important to me to be surrounded by story. What was your entry point into realizing the power of story?
Very similar early experiences. My dad also introduced me to the Hardy Boys. Read just nonstop as a kid. I didn't recognize in myself a real desire to write. It was something that, you know, I did well in school. I've got, you know, really encouraging feedback from my teachers. At some point I realized, oh, I think I'm okay at this. I think I might be onto something here. But it was never something that I considered really devoting myself to. And then in my early 20s, there were kind of two things that happened, both at about the same time, so close together that I can't remember which one came first. But one of them was reading 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, of course. And in particular, there is an image, and I don't remember the characters. This has been a quarter century since I read that book. And it's on my very short book list of books that I intend to reread. There's only been a couple of books that I've reread, but that one's going to be one of them when I get through the stack of 12 in progress books that I have right now. But there's an image, and I don't remember the characters, but one of the characters dies. And the way that his mother finds out that he's dead is a rivulet of blood that emerges from him and makes its way across the village through the dirt roads, and it comes and it finds her, this trickle of blood. And she sees this rivulet of blood appear, and she knows exactly what's happened. And when I read that, it unlocked something. It showed me something that literature could do that I did. I think on some level I knew it had that kind of power, but it just blew me away. And I just remember thinking, like, this is as an art form, as a form of communication, this is unbelievable. This is the most amazing thing I've ever come across. And you know, as a 20-year-old, you don't really aspire to be Gabriel Garcia Marquez. But I said, I want to explore this. I'm going to figure out what's going on here. I'm going to lean into this. The other thing that happened was I hiked the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu. This is a hike of about, I think it was two, three nights. I don't remember exactly. But if anybody's done that, it's extremely high altitude, very arduous, tons of climbing. You're at a deficit of oxygen, chewing on coca leaves for the altitude sickness like the locals do. And there is, I think it's the second day, you go over this pass called Warm Wanyuska Pass, which translates to Dead Woman Pass. was absolutely brutal, carrying a giant backpack. And I was with, I was traveling with, there were a couple of other Americans and a Canadian that I met in Lima, and we kind of regathered in Cuzco, and we were hiking together. These were not people that I had known previously. We just kind of fell in together as you do when you're traveling. And we were just trading stories. We were talking to each other. We were just making things up to keep ourselves from going crazy, really, to keep ourselves off of the difficulty of the hike. And at some point along that, I said, I'm going to try to write a novel. In particular, credit where credit's due, we were talking about a South Park episode. We were talking about the South Park episode where there is, it has to do with a Loch Ness monster. I don't remember the details of it, but we were recounting this episode, and I decided at that point that I was going to try to write a novel about a monster hoax in a small town. And I just formulated this idea while at altitude and under an extreme oxygen deprivation. That's when I decided that I was going to really be a writer. I was really going to try to learn the craft.
That's a really awesome origin story.
South Park and Gabriel Garcia Marquez are that's my origin story. So I did. I went and I wrote that novel. And in the course of it, I came to realize that I had no idea what I was doing. But I also came to, also in the process of that, I found a devotion in myself to the craft. I said, okay, I want to learn how to do this. If you can pick one thing that you're going to be able to do really well, this is it. And in the course of that, I found that. And so I went to grad school and I took that novel into grad school, and it got eviscerated over the next few years as I tried to incorporate every bit of wise feedback that I got from everybody. And at the end of those few years, it was completely unrecognizable from where it started, but it was kind of the training grounds for how to do it. And then I graduated, got my degree. I did one more pass at it and then put it away and then took a few deep breaths and then wrote A Paper Sun.
When you were in school for writing, did you have any classes or lessons that have stuck with you since then?
I did. There was one in particular, and I'm glad you asked, because I was just thinking about this today and how this is related to some of the plans for the writers' workshops that are coming together, which are now live on the site.
Workshops will come around later. It's the writers' groups that are live right now.
Writers' group, available now at collaborist.org. The exercise that I remember was in an experimental fiction course. I believe that's what it was. I think it was taught by Stephen Beachy, whose novel, The Whistling Song, was one of the reasons why I picked this program. This is at the University of San Francisco in the early 2000s. But this exercise was, we were given a random collection of things. One of them was just an image, a timetable, and we had to take, and there were a few other things, or a handful of ingredients. Kind of reminds me of those cooking shows where they just give you a basket full of random things and say, go make a dessert out of this. This was the literary equivalent of that. They gave us a bunch of stuff and then they said, okay, go write a story. Paradoxically, it was so creatively freeing to have the world so constrained, seemingly constrained. And it gave me a way to start thinking about things that I never would have thought about if I hadn't had this collection of prompts. And it was open-ended enough to let us go in whatever direction, but we also had these dots that we had to connect. I borrowed that exercise last year. I was the artist in residence. I think it was in the month of June at Oregon State University, the Cascades, their MFA program. My good friend Jennifer Reimer, who teaches in the program, invited me to come, and they read A Paper Sun and they invited me to come and discuss it. And I did the Zoom version of that, where I had everybody not everybody, I had four or five people grab a book that was nearby, read a quick passage. I jotted down some phrases and some words just based on what they were reading, what they happened to have near them. Didn't tell anybody what I was writing down. Did a reading, did a presentation, did a Q&A, talked about MFAs. And then I said, all right, we're going to do this exercise. And I read them back the phrases and the words that had come from their books. And I said, all right, go and write a, we're going to go take 20 minutes or so. And we're going to go, all go write a couple pages, and you have to incorporate all these things. And it was a lot of fun. People came up with all kinds of different things. I remember that was, I did it too. And that was, that's been my one and only science fiction experiment so far. So may get back to that someday. What's going on with your writing group? How are we going to be doing similar things for people in this group?
It was maybe 2 years ago. I have no sense of time. I have no sense of time, period. But then throw in the pandemic and what is time? I really have no concept of it at this point. But one night, I listen to a lot of music on YouTube. I watch a lot of stuff on YouTube. I'm a very impulsive algorithm follower on YouTube. I guess that's one way of putting it. And at some point, one night, I had two different tabs open in my browser. And they were both on different videos on YouTube. And they were playing simultaneously. And I would watch one, and I would get the audio from that, but I would also be hearing the audio from another video. And it was disorienting in this wonderful way, because the brain is trying to make sense of all of the things coming into you at once. And I got really fascinated by it, and I started being intentional about it. And one of the cool things about YouTube is that you can slow down videos. So you can play them at 3/4 speed or half speed. Anything slower than that, the sound starts getting really compromised. You can play it faster. But what I started doing was mixing just the video, just the visuals from one video with just the audio from another. And I would try to make sense of it. And I would get really fascinated by it. And I would try to do themes. I would pick out the nightly news broadcast from some random date in the 70s. And I would put on post-rock. Usually I would use music that did not have lyrics, did not have any kind of vocals on it, just so it would set the tone, which is, of course, you know, what happens in movies. And that's why there are soundtracks and scores, is to give that little emotional thing. But in the moments when you see that in a movie, it's intentional, because it's trying to match the visuals of what you're watching with the sound of what you're hearing. And my thought was, what happens if you scramble that entirely? So I would take, for instance, a Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis movie that was supposed to be slapstick, that was supposed to be funny, that was comedy. But if you slow that down and you put some sad music, now whatever the Martin and Lewis movie's original intention is, it's having to compete with other stimulation that it's bringing in. And then I would just keep playing with it, and I'd have like 3 or 4 videos going at once. And I really started thinking about how you can recalibrate your emotional register, because your brain doesn't know how to make sense of what it's getting. And it's making you actively think and feel, and it sometimes is uncomfortable. And there's this whole genre of YouTube uploads where people have like home movies from the 20s and 30s and 40s. And you'll see people upload these things and they'll say, I found these reels at a vintage store. I don't know who these people are. I just bought a camera and it had this in it, or I bought a case and it had these in them. And then I would put music, you know, it's kind of been my experience in life that the music that I listen to tends to sometimes be a little mopey, a little emotional. I get into my feelings.
A lot of great mopey music.
Yeah, I get into my feelings when I'm listening to music. I write while listening to music. And I would start playing music and I would start playing these old home movies and I would just get obliterated by questions of who are these people? Where are their descendants now? What is this even being recorded? Where are they? What was their thought when they first saw what we're looking at? What was the first thought they, you know, what wasn't filmed? And it just becomes this fascinating thing. And I've spent a lot of time on Twitter and on my website over the years. When I find a particularly good mix, I would share it with people. I'd say, check this out, like do this thing. And people would comment and be like, yeah, that's really cool. And other people would be like, yeah, I don't really get what you're doing, which is fine. Cause I, you know, I concede that it's a little bit different. And I started calling them in absolute mixes. And I'd gotten fascinated with the word in absolute, which is something that I think I made up. I don't think it exists in the dictionary. And the whole idea behind in absolute to me, because if I'm going to create a word, I can get to define it as well, is that in any given moment, there is the sum of all things. That's everything. But a second later, the sum of all things is something different. There's new things. There's things go away, things appear. And that to me is when I'm doing those in absolute mixes, is it's like whatever you're feeling in the moment is all that there is. But you can push play or somebody else can push play and watch it and it means something completely different. So it's everything, but it's also not everything. And that's kind of the concept behind it. So anyway, long story short, at Collaborist, we're making groups available for free for people to join, writers groups. We want to have published authors and publishing industry professionals leading these groups so that we can talk about craft, we can talk about the market, we can talk about whatever is needed in a group. And these groups are tailored with descriptions about what they are, what they're going to be focusing on, who's leading them, etc. And I was putting up groups that are going to be led by Sarah Henry and Ted Flanagan and Carolyn Adams. And then I thought, there are no adults in the room who can stop me from creating a writer's group that uses this YouTube in absolute mix as its starting point. And I thought, how cool would it be to assemble a group? We all sit around and watch a person's creation. And then go write a story about what we interpreted, what we saw from that prompt. No discussion about what we all saw. Like that is everybody's own process. And it should not be contaminated by other people's thoughts. But so group, the first meeting, somebody assembles their own in absolute mix. They play it for the group. Everyone goes off and writes their own story about it. We come back together. And we talk about the stories that we wrote, why we wrote them, and then somebody else gets to share their in absolute mix. And then we repeat the process. And for me, I want to break the standard writers group expectations. And I really want to push this as what is here. It's like I've found this hole in the ground. And I think that there's something valuable inside. And I'm just saying, let's all grab shovels and see what we find. And there is no right expectation. There is no my way is the best way. I just want to explore this concept and wanted to make available for people who would be explorers to join and contribute and add to that. So yeah, I'm super excited about those groups. And it's definitely in line with the experimental fiction class you took and the idea of here are some prompts, let your brain do what your brain does.
I'm looking forward to seeing what gets dug up with your collective shovels.
You and me both. To join that group or any of the other groups, you can go to collaborist.org and there is a drop down option on the community tab that will take you to groups. Would love it for anyone to sign up. Don't have to sign up just for my in absolute mix group. There are other offerings that may be better suited for people. novel writing, memoir, other sides of craft. And yeah, I'm really excited. And like, this is one of the things that I'm most excited about with Collaboris, is being able to build community around groups that are tailored for different people and will provide them the support and the resources that they need. I think that's pretty much it from this episode. Do you have anything to add before we do our big sign off, Jay?
Yeah, I wanted to recap / plug some of the books that we mentioned here today as being particularly influential. One is The Whistling Song by Stephen Beachy, who was one of my teachers at University of San Francisco. Another is 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, somebody you might have heard of. My friend Jennifer Reimer, currently at Oregon State, wrote a book called The Rainy Season Diaries, which is one of my favorite books ever. If I had to pick 5 books to be stranded with on a desert island, that would definitely be one of them. And those will be in the show notes. And I think that's it for us.
Well, we definitely want to plug into the Hardy Boys and the work of F.W. Dixon. And I will also just mention that Franny and Zooey by J.D. Salinger has been an influential book on me. Thank you for listening to Collaboracast. If you haven't already, please feel free to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a follow on social media. Right now, we're over on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn for all of you corporate types. I think that's it, Jay.
For story.
For community.
Collaborist. The timing was awful.